Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to begin the book of Leviticus today. We're going to have the unenviable task of trying to do chapters 1 through 7, as well as introduce the book briefly. So I think it'll help us to kind of see an outline form and maybe to go through this and see what exactly the author was talking about without trying to do all the detailed ritual here. I'm going to be sending you a very detailed outline, one of the ritual, how it occurred, and the second part would be some exegetical notes through these chapters. I want to mention three books to you that I think will be very, very helpful. The first one is this book on Old Testament words. It's The Synonyms of the Old Testament by Griddlestone. This will really help you understand Old Testament. It's indexed extensively, put out by Erdmans. I hope you'll get it, especially on a book like Leviticus. And the two commentaries I recommend for really the whole Bible, this is Leviticus in the Tyndale Old Testament series. This is a paperback. It's not very expensive. You'll really like it. I like all the Tyndale commentaries, both Old Testament and New. And in this, I guess my favorite one is the New International Commentary. This is the Old Testament section of that. And this is very, very helpful by Winham. The other one is by Harrison, R.K. Harrison. And I think these textbooks will help you extensively in the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus basically breaks into two halves, chapter 1 through 16 on how do you approach a holy God, and then 17 through the end of the book on how do you stay in communion with a holy God. Chapters 1 through 7 are basically the different kinds of sacrifices that were available to the Hebrew community. Chapters 1 through 5, right in there, really it goes to about 6-7, 1 through 6-7, basically deals with the people and how they come. And then the rest of this, the latter part of 6 and 7, is the priest and how they do the ritual when the people do come. So here we have both aspects. And I kind of want to give you that outline before we start, if we could. First of all, I would say it's a list of sacrifices, chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 7, verse 38. Number 1 is the burnt offering. It's chapter 1, verses 3 through 17, and it's picked up in the priest part in chapter 6, verses 8 through 13. And then we have the meal offering, or the cereal offering, or the grain offering, depending on what translation you have. It's chapter 2, and then chapter 6, verses 14 through 23. Then we have the peace offering, or the fellowship offering, or the communal offering. It's found basically in chapter 3, and also in chapter 7, verses 11 through 24 is where it deals with the priest. And then uniquely, also in chapter 7, verses 22 and 24, it deals with the peace offering again. And then the sin offering is found in chapter 4, 1 through 5, 13, and the priest part in chapter 6, verse 24 through 30. And then we have the guilt offering. It's found in chapter 5, verse 14 through 26, and again the priest part in chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. The beginning of chapter 6, verses 1 through 7, deals with some of the conditions for sacrifice. And basically, I think when you see it in context, it's going to list some of the intentional sins that are covered. And then we're going to have a basic summary in chapter 7, verse 37 and 38. Now, let's go back and start the beginning of the book if we could. Then the Lord called to Moses. The title of this book in Hebrew is, And He Called, meaning Yahweh. The Talmud calls it the Law of the Priest. But the Septuagint called it the Levitical Book. And that's followed by the Vulgate, which called it Leviticus, having to do with the Levites, and that's where we get this English title. Notice where it says, And when Moses spoke to him. Now, we learn back from Exodus 20, verses 18 through 21, that the people were afraid of God when he came down the mountain. His voice sounded like thunder, the mountain quaked, and so God began to speak through Moses to the people instead of directly to the people. Okay? So, basically, Leviticus is given while they're at Mount Sinai, before they leave on the wilderness wandering experience. Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, When any man of you brings an offering. Now this when implies a voluntary nature. Now there were some burnt offerings that were offered at regular intervals. Burnt offerings are the oldest kind of offering. It means that which goes up, and it means the offering was totally consumed. We see it back in Genesis chapter 8, verse 20, where Noah offered a sacrifice to God as soon as he came out of the ark. We also see it in Genesis 22 when God told him to offer Isaac. That was a form of burnt offering. We see it in Judges 6, 19 through 21, Judges 11, 31, Judges 13, 19 through 21, 1 Samuel 6, 15, 1 Samuel 7, 9, and 1 Kings 18, 21 through 40. And so it's a very ancient kind of sacrifice. Now, there were some regular kind of burnt offerings. There was the called the continual, which meant the morning lamb sacrificed and the evening. 9 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's Exodus 29, 39 through 42. Then there was the Sabbath, where that was done twice, a double offering of continual, Numbers 28, 9 and 10. Then there was every feast day, there was a burnt offering. You can see that in Numbers 28 and 29. Then on the Day of Atonement was a special burnt offering for the whole community, Leviticus 16. And I think when you compare all those, you'll see that this is a burnt offering, but of a voluntary nature. And the question has always been, what does it mean? Well, it seems to involve something of the substitutionary nature of this innocent animal for man's sin. But the burnt offering seems to deal with sin in general, while the sin offering and the guilt offering seems to deal with specific acts of sin. The sin offering, those acts of sin to which restitution cannot be made, and guilt offering, those acts of sin to which restitution can be made. And so several of these categories are meant to bring man back into a right relationship with God. Now the word offering here is the word korban. You might want to see Mark chapter 7, verse 11, where Jesus talks about that. It simply means an offering in general, okay? To the Lord, and you shall bring the offering from the animals from the herd of the flock, basically domestic animals. If it's an offering, it's a burnt offering, means that which goes up from the herd, he shall offer it. Now, I want to give you a series down, verses 3 through 6, of all the thing that the offerer, not the priest, but the offerer was to do. He was actively involved in this sacrifice. He shall offer it. He shall bring it to the door of the meeting. That's in verse 3. He shall press his hands on the head of it. That's in verse 4. He shall kill it himself. Verse 5. He shall skin it. Verse 6. And he shall cut it into pieces. Now the priest will collect the blood and lay the pieces on the altar and sprinkle the blood around the sacrificial altar. That's the priest's part. And that's seen in a little different chapter here, particularly chapter 8, verses 8 through 13. Notice it mentions here that it shall be a male. Now, several times, if it's a kind of a sin offering, it's a male. And other of the peace offerings, it can be a male or a female. It seems to be degrading here in the sense of a more expensive sacrifice and a less expensive sacrifice. It kind of runs from the high priest to the people as a whole, to the leaders, to the poor of the individual. And so you see it, God is making provision for all aspects of society in this sacrificial system. Now some say it was a male because it cost more, and that may be true when you compare chapter 4 verses 23 and 24. Some say no, there you didn't need quite as many males for a herd as you do females. But I think the emphasis here is on the costliness of the sacrifice, and so I think a male is meant to be a more expensive animal. Without defect. Now what does that mean? Well, you might want to see chapter 22 verses 18 through 25, where the defects are spelled out. No mottled color, no blindness, no lameness, no disease, because you're giving your best to God. Now notice that he shall come to the tent of meeting, that's the tabernacle. The priest will meet him there. He shall lay his hands. That's kind of a weak translation. The Hebrew here means to press or to lean on. It's a way of kind of identifying the offer with the animal. This press is used quite often, and you can see it in the notes how many times it's used. That it may be accepted for him. Now, if you compare this with several other places, let's say a good example might be Numbers 8, verse 10, you see this laying hands on was a way of identifying with someone, making them a representative of you. And that's what I think it's used here. May be acceptable, made him acceptable for atonement on his behalf. Now the word atonement, we used to say it meant covering. It's the word Kippur in Hebrew, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. But new etymological study has seemed to reveal that it either comes from a different root to mean to wipe clean, or from another root to cleanse. And that's probably a better etymology there. Let's see. Notice that the priest shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Now, some of these sacrifices are going to, the blood's going to be put on the altar. The more serious sacrifices, like for the priest that sins, or the whole people that sins, the blood will be taken into the holy place and sprinkled before the veil. Only the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16, is the blood taken behind the veil and put on the mercy seat where God symbolically dwells. Now, notice it says that he's going to skin the animal. We learn from chapter 7, verse 8, the skin belongs to the priest. He shall cut it in pieces, and the priest's going to lay it in an order on the sacrificial altar. That's that big bronze altar right when you come into the door of the tent of meeting. If you look at verse 7, it mentions the altar there. That's described in detail in Exodus 27, 1 through 8, and you might want to see that. He arranged the pieces we see there in verse 8, kind of like the animal was in real life, okay? Let's see. He had to wash, the offerer had to wash its legs. That's another thing the offerer had to do. And that was to kind of get, we think, the excrement off, make it clean so there wouldn't be any refuge on it. Now, let's see. The word suet here in my New American in verse 8 means fatty portions. Let's see. It was to offer it by fire. Now, this idea of by fire means it, like it's a food being offered, or it's the idea of a gift of expiation or propitiation, or some say a rich gift. This is a very rare Hebrew word, offered by fire. We're not sure what it means. This soothing aroma to the Lord, you might want to see back in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, where it's first used. It does not mean that God smells this and then comes and eats the sacrifice. That's the Mesopotamian culture. That's not Israel's worship. But somehow it was soothing because man was right with God again. This word is used over and over, and it's even used in the New Testament twice, the allusion to this, in Ephesians 5, 2 and Philippians 4, 18. Notice then, for the poor down here, they could offer turtle doves. They didn't have this expensive thing. And the priest did most of the work for turtle doves. Could be either sex, because you can't tell with a bird real easy. And so here's God's provision. But the man still had to, verse 16, take the craw, or the crop, out. And some think it means defeather it. Others think it means throw the contents away. Again, the Hebrew word is too rare here for us to really know. It, by the way, verse 16 kind of gives us a hint at where the place of the ashes was. It seems to be inside the tabernacle area, somewhere to the east of the sacrificial altar. Now, in chapter 2, we're dealing with the grain offering. King James calls it meat, but it simply means grain of some kind. Basically, the Hebrew word here means gift, the idea of a gift. It should be flour. It should have oil on it and put frankincense on it. Now, this is kind of a way of symbolizing the common, everyday things that the Israelis would have for food. It was like a thing out of the kitchen, if you please, out of the normal life. Now, we learn from several other passages, like Exodus 39:40, Numbers 15:5 and 10, and Leviticus 23:13, that this was usually offered with wine. Matter of fact, we learn from most other passages that this was very seldom offered by itself. It was usually offered with the burnt offering, or it was offered with the peace offering, and other kinds of offering included this, because this is going to be food for the priest, and they needed more than just meat. Of course, the rabbis say that if a very, very poor person, they could offer a grain sacrifice instead of a blood sacrifice, but we're not really sure of that. In your notes, I'll give you all the places where this type of grain accompanies other sacrifices, okay? Notice where it says a handful of fine flour. Notice the rabbi said 3 fingers is all that was given on the altar, a handful like that. The rest the priest got to eat. It was kind of the priest way of tithing of what they got for their own food. Notice frankincense. Now, frankincense is kind of the excretion from certain plants. We know it was used in part of the incense, one of the 4 parts of incense back in Exodus chapter 30, verse 34. It came to symbolize some significance, but I want to say to you right here, be very careful of reading all this symbolism from the New Testament back in this Old Testament sacrifices, because the truth is we can't prove it from the text, and commentators have many different opinions on this, so we can't be dogmatic at all about that. Notice it becomes one of the most holy things in verse 3, meaning only the priest could eat it. Now it mentions unleavened cakes here. Now, of course, leavened cakes are going to be offered later on with the first fruits, Leviticus 23. They're even going to be included in part of the priest's, part of the sacrifice that does not is not burnt up on the altar in chapter 7. I believe it's verse 8. But you will see that it's not a symbol of sin always. Notice it mentions down here at verse 9, its memorial portion. That's that handful of flour that the priest offers on the altar of sacrifice, and the rest he got to use for himself. Now, notice in verse 11 and 12, it mentions that we can't mix leaven or honey. Now, why is that? Well, we really don't know, because honey is mentioned in an offering during Hezekiah's time, 2 Chronicles 31:5. Leaven is included in several offerings. I just mentioned that to you. Chapter 7, verse 13, is also in Exodus 23, verses 16 and 17, Exodus 34, 22 and 23, Leviticus 23, 17 and 18. It's included as a sacrifice, so it cannot be a word for sin. Well, what does it mean? Well, some say because it has the fermentation qualities, and that kind of both honey and leaven. I don't think that's it. Some say it's because leaven is still alive. We just don't know what it is. We just don't know. I really think it was probably involved in Canaanite ritual in some way, and that's why it was excluded. Notice in verse 13, we mention this covenant of salt. There cannot be a grain offering offered without salt. Now, salt, we know, is used in Roman sacrifices, Greek sacrifices. There's even a salt covenant mentioned in the Bible, Numbers 18:19, 2 Chronicles 13:5, and Ezekiel 43:24. Salt had the symbolism of permanence, the symbolism of purity, the symbolism of necessity of life, the symbolism of a way of friendship meals. And which exactly one of these it is, I'm just not sure. Now, in chapter 3, I think it's very interesting, as we move to the peace offering. The literal word here in Hebrew means to slaughter. There are several kinds of peace offerings. There's a thank offering, a vow offering, and a free will offering. And all that speculation on exactly what it means is somewhat ambiguous, so dogmatism is inappropriate. Now, you could use a male or a female here. This was like a fellowship meal. It's still voluntary. You didn't have to do this. Many of us believe the Lord's Supper has a great analogy in this, where God symbolically dwelt with a man and he ate meat with his friends. They had meat very rarely. It was a rare occasion. They even had smaller kind of sacrifices for those who were poor. You didn't have to bring a bull. You could bring a goat or a sheep or something like that. Notice in verse 17 it says it shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. Now, this little phrase, perpetual statutes, the Hebrew word olam, which can mean for this period of time, for eternity, it kind of depends on the context. This little phrase is used quite often in Leviticus. I'll have it in your notes. It's one of the ways to divide the book up. We think this is like in the book of Genesis, these are the generations of the author's way of dividing the book. This seems to be the way of the author of Leviticus for dividing the book. Now, let's see. You can't eat fat or blood. Now, the fat symbolized the best. It was dedicated to God. The blood symbolized the life. It goes back to Genesis 9, 4, and 5. We see in Leviticus 17, 11 that life's in the blood. So the blood belongs to God. Man can't eat meat with blood in it. And the fat belongs to God because that's the part that God gets in the sacrifice. And so it's excluded completely from man. Now, in chapter 4 and 5, we see that chapter 4, verses 1 through 13, is where restitution was possible, okay? Restitution is impossible. That's called a sin offering. Then in chapter 5:14 through chapter 6, verse 7, restitution is possible, and that's called a guilt offering or a trespass offering. I think it's important you see that. As chapters 1, 2, and 3 are voluntary, chapters 4 and 5 are mandatory for sin in the camp. Now, I think it's important here. The word sin here means missing the mark. The word righteous in Hebrew means a measuring reed, and any deviation from that standard is sin, to miss the mark, to fall short, to be perverse, to be crooked, and here's the word for sin. Notice the idea of unintentionality. You might want to see chapter 5, verse 15. The New International Version and the New English Bible have the word inadvertently here. It means that they sinned without knowing it. You might want to see Numbers 15. Let's see. Can't read my own writing. I believe 27 and 31. You might want to look at that. Now, I want to outline this for you real quick, because in chapter 4, verses 3 through 12 are for the high priest when he sins unintentionally. Verses 13 through 21 is for the whole nation when it sins. The rabbis say here for the council that guides the nation. That fits the context best. Verses 22 through 26 is a tribal leader that sins. And then verses 27 through 35 is for the individual that sins. In the first two of these, the high priest and the nation as a whole, the blood was taken inside the holy place. On the other two, it was simply poured out at the base of the altar of sacrifice, which shows two different kinds, the significance of the sin involved. Notice in verse 3 it says, if the anointed priest who sins so far as to bring guilt on the people. Notice that the high priest sins, that all the people have sinned in their life. And this is that idea of the corporateness of sin, as well as the individual aspect of sin when an individual believer must come because of sin. Let's see. The different types of sacrifice here, I think, are related to an economic condition. Notice the bull is for the high priest, and there's a bull for the whole congregation, but it goes down to a lamb or a goat, and then later on for a turtle dove for those who are very, very poor. Notice that the blood sprinkles seven times in verse 6, that kind of perfect number. Also notice that if the whole congregation sins in verse 13, now some say this means they're legal representatives. The rabbis say it means the Sanhedrin, but I think I'm not sure we can get the Sanhedrin back this early. It doesn't develop until the time of Ezra, so I think they're reading too much back. Now, this same kind of idea for the whole congregation also was the Day of Atonement, where the high priest offered a sin for the whole nation. But this kind of seemed to be some special sin during the year of which the nation needed to be expiated of immediately, and that's what this is for. Let's see. By the way, verse 26, we have the word atonement again, which we think means to cover, but I think means probably to wipe clean or to cleanse. It's the name for the mercy seat. This same word will be used in the New Testament to describe the mercy seat. Now, let me come to chapter 5, verses 1 through 13. And again, I want to mention to you in chapter 4, verses 1 through 35, in chapter 5, verses 14 through 19, we're dealing with unintentional sin. But in chapter 5, verses 1 through 13, in chapter 6, verses 1 through 7, we're dealing with intentional sin against a covenant brother. Now, it is intentional in the sense that you knew you were doing it, but you did it against your brother, not against God. But in a sense, to sin against your covenant brother is to sin against God. There's a Godward aspect of this sacrifice. There's a manward aspect of this sacrifice. If it is Godward, you present a sin offering and you can't make restitution. But if it's manward, you also give a sin offering, but you make restitution, one-fifth or whatever. And so I think you see these different kinds of sacrifices. In chapter 5, verses 1 through 13, there seems to be three different categories of this kind of intentional sin. The first one is you're not a witness in court when you should be. Number two is you touch something unclean but really without not knowing it. And number three is a rash oath that you make in God's name. Implication may be intoxicated, and you can be expiated from that. Notice in verse 7 it mentions, verse both 7 and 11, if he had insufficient means, he could offer a different kind of sacrifice, a lamb in verse 7, two turtle doves or two young pigeons in verse 11. God always cared for the poor. The guilt offering begins in verse 14. It's very much like the sin offering, except that there is also restitution that has to be made. Notice in chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, we kind of bring together some of these other intentional sins against a brother. You steal a deposit, you rob him, you cheat him, you lost something and lied about it. Now, these are intentional sins. It's important to know that there is no sacrifice for intentional sins against God. That's why David couldn't offer a sacrifice in Psalm 51 except a broken and contrite heart. But there is sacrifice for these rather mechanical and somewhat limited sins of intentionality, but that's only in a very limited way. Notice they had to pay back what they had plus one-fifth. That's in verse 5. In verses 6-8 through chapter 7, verse 38, is the priest's duty. It deals with the same sacrifices we've dealt with in chapters 1 through 5, but now it's the priest part. We talk about how the offerer comes, and it's basically the same way. He comes to the tent of meeting. He kills the animal except for the turtle doves. He skins it himself. He cuts it up. He washes the back legs. That's all the offerer's part. Now we're going to get into the priest part. We can't be real hard and fast on that because it's a little fluid between these categories, but it does hold pretty much. Notice in verse 9 there to keep the fire on the altar burning. Same thing said in verse 12, same thing in verse 13. Well, that seems to kind of contradict chapter 1, verse 7, where they're told to start a fire on the altar. Some have said chapter 1, verse 7 is in case someone brings an offering during the wilderness wandering period, but this other one is the continual sacrifice that's done every morning and every evening, and they had to keep the fires burning. For this continual, you might want to see Numbers 28, verses 3 through 8. Let's see. The priest grain offering is mentioned in verses 19 through 23, and this is something the priest brought for God. Some say they brought it every day. Others say no, they only brought it once when they were anointed. And it seems to me they brought it every day, and that's another reason why the fire was continued. It's kind of the priest's continual tithe and continual offering to God. Notice in verse 23, it shall not be eaten because it's a special kind of sacrifice. This priest grain offering was not mentioned at all earlier when we're talking about the people, but it's found this uniquely priestly section. Then chapter 8 deals with the same kind of information to the priest about what to offer and when to offer. I've given you extensive notes on how, and I can't cover it in the amount of time that I have to do this many chapters. Notice it says, in his uncleanness, that person shall be cut off from his people. Now, how can you become unclean? Well, chapter 11, you can eat the wrong kind of food. Chapter 12 through 15, you can have bodily emissions. And then chapter 22 of Leviticus describes other ways that a man can be unclean. If he participated in a fellowship meal while knowingly unclean, he was to be cut off from his people. That's verse 20 and 21. Now, that means the judgment of God would fall on him, and the implication is that he would die. There were serious consequences for violating this holiness code. Notice again in verse 23, it mentions that you shall not eat fat. Again, fat is God's special part, and that we'll see chapter 3, verse 17. Those in verse 26, the prohibition against blood is there. Again, the life's in the blood, Leviticus 11, 17. And here's some other places where the blood is seen to be so significant. Genesis 9, verses 4 through 6, Deuteronomy 12, verses 16 and 23 through 25, and Deuteronomy 15, 23. The life's in the blood. It's sacred to God. Now, this wave offering is interesting. Notice that the offerer will bring it with his own hands to the priest. Now, some say they wave it like this, symbolically to give it to God and God to give it back. Some say they wave it like this. Some rabbis say there's two different kinds because there's two different Hebrew words here. One means this way and one means this way. But tell you the truth, the etymology is uncertain and we just don't have any idea of what this wave offering means. But it seems to symbolize that which is given to God. In verse 31, the word breast is mentioned and a hind leg is the priest offering. We have found a Canaanite temple in the city of Lachish, somewhere that was destroyed while in use around 1220 B.C., some say at the time of Joshua's conquest. And in the archaeological site, there was a lot of the bones of the forepart of an animal, which seems to say that this forearm, this shoulder piece, had a special significance to Canaanite people. But exactly what it is, we're not sure, and we're not sure of the significance here. Now, verses 37 and 38 are a summary of all of chapters 1 through 7. It's very interesting to me, as a point of the historicity of this, that Mesopotamian documents use their index at the last. And that thing with this is, it's a summary that really is used as an index, which I think shows the historicity of a second millennium B.C. authorship date for the Pentateuch. Well, I'm sorry this has been so fast. Please look at these books. The New International Commentary has some good New Testament application. So does the Tyndale Commentary. Be careful of not being too dogmatic of spiritualizing these texts of how they relate to Christ. And the notes will be extensive. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.